trip out to the west. Do you know the culture's in love because the surf is the best? I live for cars and girls.
And you're still listening to the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. That there was the Untamed Youth with I Live for Cars and Girls, written by Andy Chernoff and produced by Andy Chernoff and Billy Miller from the Untamed Youth album More Gone Gassers. And before that, other Andy Chernoff related stuff. We heard Are You Ready to Rapture by Andy Chernoff. And before that, we heard Let's Get the Band Back Together by Andy Chernoff. Any info on Andy Chernoff can be found at andychernoff.com. Andy Chernoff from New York City. And before that, to begin the set, we had the Dirty Nil with Beat. And the Dirty Nil are from Hamilton, Ontario. And all this music comes courtesy Manolis from Hamilton, Ontario. Thank you, Manolis, for getting people to send me music. And if you're interested in sending me, Nardwar, to Human Serviette Music, please do. Nardwar@nardwar.com. Or you can send it to Nardwar, care of CITR Radio, 6138 Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T2A5, CITR Radio. Or more info at CITR.ca or Nardwar.ca. Right now, going to end the Nardwar to Human Serviette Radio Show with something by the band Cool from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We're going to hear the song Green from their album Paint. Here is Cool on the Nardwar to Human Serviette Radio Show. And do to do do do. Cool.
Oh, my friend, it's jealousy in the green. I monster likes 2 feet, and I don't know if I'll ever get there. I seem to always judge and compare. Did you ever have that dream where all your teeth seem to fall out? Oh, those dreams, they seem to haunt me. Oh, they must mean something right. I could say those were the best days, but that would be such a lie.
Die a bit inside. I could say those were the best days. But that would be such a lie. But it's alright, maybe it's alright, maybe it's alright when they're gone.
Escape Plan comes to the Rickshaw Theater on tour to support their latest release, One of Us is the Killer, featuring special guests Trash Talk, Retox, and Shiny. Tickets are $20 in advance and are available at Red Cat, Neptune, Zulu, High Life, and Scrape Records, or online at ticketweb.ca. For more information, go to timbreconcerts.com. On Thursday, June 12th at the Rickshaw Theater, Vancouver-based Destroyer performs solo in support of his latest EP, Five Spanish Songs, available through Merge Records and Dead Ocean Records. Dale que toma, toma que dale, baila y que se marchen las mañanas. Featuring special guest Blackout Beach. Tickets are available at Northern Tickets, Red Cat Records, Zulu Records, or online at northerntickets.com. For more information, go to destroyersongs.com.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more.
Friday, 18th of April, Good Friday. I am Joshua Gabbitwyo.
And I'm Konstantin Prudanovich. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
It is currently 5:10, and you're in for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Segment one today, we are thrilled to welcome Marco of CITR's Astro Talk to talk on the program. It's a science talk. He'll be talking about this week's lunar eclipse.
On segment two, we're going to have coverage of the annual Undie Run by news correspondent Morme Zanke, who participated in the campus event this past Wednesday.
We're thrilled.
Our third segment will be by our news correspondent, Rachel Bergen. She's doing a segment on Wi-Fi.
We'll also have coverage of the university's recent announcement of intentions to review its current investment and pursue responsible investing strategies.
And a report from correspondent Christine Kim on the tragic South Korean ferry accident this past Wednesday.
We have Alistair to host a roundtable discussion of UBC's pro-life student club, the Genocide Awareness Project, which this year did not hold its annual demonstration.
And now for some headlines for today. In campus news, hundreds of students ran around UBC's campus in their undies to celebrate the end of the academic year. The so-called Undie Run has become a standing tradition on our campus, marking its fifth year on Wednesday. We'll have more on this story later in the program from veteran Undie Run reporter Morme Zanke, who was on the ground to witness the ensuing nakedness.
In local news, BC Teachers Federation President Jim Eicher has announced that his union is issuing a 72-hour strike notice as of last Thursday, citing a lack of progress to the bargaining table. Eicher said the job action will likely come to Wednesday, April 23rd, in the case that the government is willing to negotiate. On the pending action, Eicher stated, quote, "Teachers will not accept the restriping of our rights in class sizes and class composition. We believe these ratios are best based on the collective agreement and not in government regulation. 90% of teachers who cast ballots at the beginning of the month voted in favor of the job action. However, an all-out strike is not expected anytime soon. Relations between the BC government and the teachers have been contentious since the early 2000s, when the BC government passed legislation that stripped teachers of the rights to negotiate class size, compensation, and staffing. Last April, the BC Supreme Court ruled the legislation was unconstitutional and gave the province 1 year to restore teachers' collective bargaining rights, an action which it failed to take and was eventually fined $2 million. Our news team here at CITR plans to follow this story closely as it develops in order to bring you more.
Five people are dead after a stabbing in a quiet Calgary suburb. A dozen or so people were gathered for a party to celebrate the end of the school year at the University of Calgary before UOC student Matthew Grood brutally stabbed five of the partygoers to death. DeGrood was a welcome guest at the party and apparently close to one of the victims, which raised many questions as to the motive of the stabbings. DeGrood is now being charged with five counts of first-degree murder in connection to the killings of Lawrence Hong, Josh Hunter, Caitlin Pereiras, Zachariah Rathwell, and Jordan Segura. DeGrood's parents spoke out for the first time on Thursday, extending their condolences to the victims' families and maintaining their unconditional love for their son. Doug DeGrood, Matthew's father, said, quote, "We are trying to make sense of what happened. We are deeply saddened for what the families and friends of the victims are going through. Your lives have been turned upside down. We know words cannot begin to ease your pain and suffering." An Alberta justice official said earlier this week, DeGrood will likely undergo a psychiatric assessment as the case moves forward in court. "For now, the entire community is reeling from a tragedy and has no choice but to learn to cope with what has happened. Throughout the week, classmates, friends, and family members of the victims have held vigils and gatherings to celebrate the lives of those they lost. Perhaps someday we will have answers as to what led to what seems like a completely pointless and cruel tragedy."
The Canadian government is deploying six CF-18 fighter jets to help NATO allies in Eastern Europe as the crisis in Ukraine escalates. Prime Minister Harper announced the new measures Thursday morning in Ottawa, along with the fighter jets. Canada plans to lend more military personnel to help patrol the skies over Eastern Europe, European NATO member countries. NATO Secretary General Anders von Ramsen said this Wednesday that the alliance of the resource needs to bolster the presence of Eastern European and expected that NATO members to come forward with additional contributions. Eastern European leaders have been vocal about their concerns with Vladimir Putin's potential agenda, which they believe could put their states in jeopardy. Harper reflected on these concerns in his latest address, stating, quote, "I believe this to be long-term serious threat to global peace and security. Thus far, Canada has imposed visa bans and sanctions on a number of Russian officials and recalled its ambassador to Moscow." Harper and Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird has publicly scolded Russia over the actions in Ukraine, but had not until Thursday offered military assistance to the region. Canada has also pledged $220 million towards the restoration of economic stability in Ukraine. In a written statement, Harper announced, quote, "We will continue to monitor these events closely and take coordinated action to enhance European security and show our support to the people of Ukraine."
The Federal Court of Appeals has held a landmark ruling that grants Métis people Indian status in Canada. The ruling could extend Ottawa's responsibilities to hundreds of thousands of Aboriginal people who are not affiliated with reserves and have no access to First Nations programs, services, and rights. This legal battle has been played out since 1999, when the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples and several Métis and non-status Indians took the federal government to court alleging discrimination because they were not considered Indians under a section of the Constitution. The benefits they were allegedly denied included access to the same health care and education funding available to status Indians, being allowed to hunt, trap, and fish and gather on public lands, the ability to negotiate and enter into treaties with the federal government. A federal court ruling last year brought Métis and non-status Indians into the ranks of people considered Indians under the Constitution. On Thursday, the appeals court upheld that part of the decision, ruling that Métis are included as Indians under the Constitution, but not non-status Indians. In an email to CTV News, Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcourt's office said, quote, "We are pleased that the court granted parts of our appeal, and we are reviewing all elements of today's decision to determine the next steps." The email went on to say that their goal is ultimately to create jobs, economic growth, and long-term prosperity for all Canadians, including Métis individuals.
Those are your UBC campus, local, national, international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Doxa Documentary Film Festival discovers new forms of nonfiction film. Everything from mountain gorillas to cartoon ponies and the men who love them. With a special spotlight program, Secrets and Lies, that examines the art of deception. The festival is happening May 2nd to 11th. For more information, go to www.doxafestival.ca.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
It's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Marco of CITR's Astro Talk to perform... Or to the program, sorry. He'll be talking about this week's lunar eclipse.
Good afternoon. My name is Marco, and you're listening to Science Talk on CITR Radio. Today I'm going to be talking about the total lunar eclipse that occurred last Tuesday in the early morning hours, Tuesday, April 14th, 2014. This was a rare eclipse for a few reasons. The planet Mars was at its closest approach to Earth in many years. So on Monday, one day before the eclipse, Mars was as close as it's been in many, many years to the Earth. There was also a number of stars and other planets. The planet Saturn was relatively close to the Moon, and the star Spica, a bluish star, appeared very close to the Moon during the eclipse, and Spica is a bluish star, so it would have, anybody who saw the eclipse would have seen a very nice light show with numerous stars and numerous planets surrounding a moon that appeared three-dimensional, and it was red and it floated in the sky, so it was a very nice light show. So this is the first of four total eclipses that will occur in a row, so that's why these four are called a tetrad of eclipses, because they are not separated by any partial eclipses. So this first eclipse occurred April 15th, 2014, The next one's going to be October 8th, 2014, then April 8th, 2015, and September 15, 2015. So these are four eclipses that are occurring right in a row. So what is a total lunar eclipse? Well, a total lunar eclipse, or even a partial lunar eclipse, occur only at a new or full moon. An eclipse happens when the Earth blocks the light of the sun from shining onto the moon. So the star, or our star, which is the sun, is in direct alignment with the Earth and the moon. So the Earth sits in between the sun and the moon, so it blocks the light of the sun from reaching the moon. The sun and the moon are therefore in directly opposite directions as seen from the Earth during the eclipse. So the lunar eclipse occurs when the moon passes within the Earth's umbra or shadow. There's two types of shadows that the Earth has. One is called the penumbra. This is the lighter outer shadow of the Earth. And this is what covers the moon in the beginning of the eclipse. Later on in the middle of the eclipse, there's another shadow. It's called the umbra. It's the darker inner shadow of the Earth. So the Earth's shadow during the eclipse temporarily blocks the light of the sun from reaching the moon, so the moon is darkened. So this eclipse lasted for 3.5 hours, and again, the special feature of this eclipse was the moon appeared as a blood red color. An astronaut on the moon, though, would not see a red color. This astronaut would be enveloped in total darkness. Why does the red color appear in the moon as seen from the Earth? Before we discuss the eclipse, we should therefore talk about why on Earth we saw the moon as appearing as a red color. The red color on the moon occurs because of something called Rayleigh scattering. Lord Rayleigh was a British scientist. So about 140 years ago in 1871, Lord Rayleigh discovered something called Rayleigh scattering. So this has to do with how different wavelengths of light are scattered by air molecules in our atmosphere. So the Rayleigh scattering occurs in our atmosphere, and it occurs when sunlight enters the atmosphere and interacts with particles in our atmosphere. So what is scattering? When light enters a molecule in the atmosphere and then it's redirected by that molecule, this is called scattering. Rayleigh discovered that the intensity and amount of the scattering of any light is dependent on the wavelength of the light. So the intensity of the light is inversely proportional to the wavelength to the power of 4. And it helps explain why our sky is blue and why our sunsets appear red. So when we discuss our blue sky, this happens because when sunlight passes through the Earth's atmosphere and is scattered by the air molecules in... Okay, the intensity of the scattering of the light from the sun is dependent on the wavelength of the light. So Rayleigh discovered the intensity is inversely proportional to 1 over the wavelength to the 4th power. Since blue light is 1.8 times shorter than red light, if you take 1.8 to the 4th power, that gives you a sum of about 10. So blue light interacts with air molecules in the atmosphere because the blue light is on the order of the size of the air molecules. So when it does, the intensity of the scattered light is 10 times brighter than the red light. Plus the blue light interacts much more than the red light does. So when we see light coming directly to us from the sun, this light is not scattered very much, so we see mostly a kind of white or reddish sun, maybe a bit yellow. But in our sky, we have, because the blue light is scattered, then the light appears blue. But at sunset or when the sun is rising, the our line of sight to the sun, we have to look through a lot more atmosphere. So when the blue light hits our atmosphere, it's scattered a lot, and it scatters itself out of existence. So all we see is the red light. So during the eclipse, what will happen is the red light that has been traveling through the thickest parts of the atmosphere that will be bent or refracted at the outer surface of the Earth. So in the totality of the eclipse, that means right in the middle, we will see the moon as red. Since the Earth is blocking all sunlight from the sun, we would assume that the Earth should, or the moon should be totally black, but it's not. So that's why we have a reddish moon. It's called the blood moon, because the red light that we usually see at sunset, this red light is bent by the outer edges of the Earth and is refracted or bent onto the surface of the moon. So one interesting thing, if you see somebody smoking a cigar, you might notice that the smoke is blue or bluish color. So what happens there is the light that goes through the smoke, its wavelength of the blue light is on the order of the same size of the molecules. So it is scattered more effectively and at a greater intensity than all the other colors. Okay, so now we're going to get back to the eclipse. At 3:53 a.m. in the morning, that's when the Earth's shadow started to cross the moon's surface. This is called the penumbral shadow. And penumbra is the lighter outer shadow of the Earth. And there's a darker inner shadow called the umbra. Now, umbra and penumbra are from the Latin alphabet. So a lot of our words and a lot of our nomenclature in astronomy, they are from the Greek or the Latin. So, for example, the Milky Way, it is called the Milky Way because the Milky Way galaxy. And in Greek, the word galaktikos means galaxy. And they called it Milky Way because in their myths, Juno was nursing Hercules when Hercules was a baby, and the milk spilled out onto the sky. So that's why it's called the Milky Way. So there's lots of interesting topics that can be discussed, and a lot of it has to do with the mythology of astronomy that's been developed from other cultures. So anyway, now we'll get back to the eclipse. So when the penumbra starts to cross the moon, it's a very, very faint shadow, so there's really not much intensity difference. At about 1 hour and 4 minutes into the eclipse, then the moon starts to enter the Earth's umbra shadow. So that's the dark inner shadow. And this dark inner shadow will cross the moon relatively quickly. So at this time, the moon will lessen in brightness over a certain period of time. So the umbra covers the moon for about an hour and a half. Before we reach the middle of the totality, there's something called the Japanese lantern effect. So the center of the moon is quite red, and the outer edges are still silvery or a silvery yellow or white color. So it looks like a Japanese lantern. So at totality, at 75 minutes when the umbra is covering it, the temperature of the moon at the equator drops to -260 degrees Fahrenheit, or -173 degrees Celsius. At 2 hours before that, it was 280 degrees Fahrenheit or 127 degrees Celsius. So there's a drastic temperature change. So after the moon is in the totality for an hour and a half, it comes out of the umbra, and about an hour after that, it passes into the umbra shadow, which means we have a light moon again. And 3.5 hours total into the eclipse, it is over and the moon is out of the Earth's shadow. So these are the first of four eclipses. And of course, the doomsayers have come out and said they spell doom for our Earth. So in September 15, 2015, we'll look forward to what will happen to our Earth, because the Mayan calendar predicted our Earth would end a couple of years ago. So thank you for listening. This is Marco for AstroTalk on CITR Radio.
Thank you for that.
Okay.
Our next segment is Rachel Bergen's look into student opinion regarding Wi-Fi in public spaces like parks and beaches.
This week, Vancouver has been pretty rainy. Whenever the rain stops and the sun comes out, Vancouverites flock to beaches and parks to soak up the sun until the rain comes back again. Picture this. You're lounging on Kitts Beach this summer, you go to take a picture of the sun glistening on the water to post on Instagram, and you have access to free Wi-Fi. Similarly, you can listen to Songza, check your emails, check Facebook, all without tapping into the data you pay for. Trevor Loke, Vancouver's youngest park board commissioner, is pushing Vancouver to implement public Wi-Fi in parks and beaches. And now, Vancouver is one step closer to realizing this goal. Loke introduced the motion at Monday's park board meeting. Loke is hoping that by next summer, they can start working on installing Wi-Fi in the downtown area.
Well, I think that there's some great locations, certainly downtown, that make sense. I think English Bay is a good example. I think perhaps we could look at some other locations like Kitts Beach, David Lamb Park, Emery Barnes Park, Nelson Park, in sort of the downtown and surrounding areas that are very well frequented.
Lots of Vancouverites are excited about the prospect of free Wi-Fi. Are there any parks or beaches that you go to regularly?
I go to Jericho Beach and Pacific Spirit Park pretty regularly.
I go to Kitts Beach sometimes. I go to Rec Beach sometimes because I'm here. I go to Stanley Park sometimes.
How would you feel if there was free Wi-Fi available there?
If it was free, though, I think that would be probably pretty cool, actually. Yeah. Then I wouldn't have to use my data.
It would be nice.
It also would be nice to be able to, you know, check your mail or whatever for free and not use up your data.
But some are a bit hesitant about the idea.
In a way, it would also detract from your experience of being at the beach because you want to relax and take it easy. And then, you know, you're reminded about work or school or whatever it is, your responsibilities that come with you. You know, it used to be that you could go to the beach and completely forget. Maybe you have your cell phone and you get texts, but at least you wouldn't have to be thinking about, yeah, work and that kind of thing. But now it can follow you.
That would probably defeat the purpose of walking, but it would help me get lost a whole lot less.
Loke hopes to have all of Vancouver covered by Wi-Fi, but wants to be cautious about the pilot phase first.
Let's make sure that we get the pilot phase right first. Let's make sure that we roll it out properly and that it's being utilized well by residents of the city. And if that's what's happening, then I don't think there's any reason why we wouldn't want to expand it across the city. And I think that whether you're a resident or a business or a tourist in the city, Wi-Fi has some really strong benefits for people. And so I think that for those reasons, I see this as an investment to becoming a more digital and connected city and a more world-class city.
This has been Rachel Bergen with CITR 101.9 FM.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Up next, we have some close and personal coverage of the annual Undie Run by news correspondent Morme Zanke, who participated in the campus event this Wednesday.
Hello,
the sound of the 5th annual Undie Run taking off at around 10:30 p.m. on Wednesday night of this week. The Undie Run is an event that's been organized by the Ski and Board Club for 5 years now, and it's been a pretty big success. A bunch of kids get together, about 1,000 or so, abandon their exam woes and their clothes, and just run around campus. It's a good time. And what's also interesting about this event is that it's a charity, so all the clothes that are taken off from everybody are donated to a local clothing collection. So that's really good. So this year, students ran from the sub, the north entrance of the sub, through IKB, running up and down the stairs, through Vanier Residence, back around, crossing Main Mall at the main fountain, which was empty, to some disappointed hopes, and then back down to McInnes Field, where it all kind of culminated in some large mosh pit of half-naked bodies. And then people were a little disappointed because the UBC Aquatic Center outdoor pool was empty, out of service. They shut that down this year. So there's nowhere to jump in and swim like in previous years. So what students did was they gravitated to the only source of water left, which was the marsh fountain that descends from Main Mall down University Boulevard. And yeah, people jumped in and seemed to enjoy this. It was a little messy, but yeah, it worked as a water source for their pleasure. I was there, I had a chance to talk to students going into the run, how they felt about it, how they heard about it, and this is what they had to say.
All right, so I'm Reed, I'm in engineering, and I heard about the Undie Run from the event on Facebook and through friends who invited me to it, and I was like, okay, well, all my friends are doing it, and I have a whole bunch of clothes I'm going to donate anyways, so it's like a good opportunity to do that all collectively and get a whole bunch of people involved to donate clothes. It's a good cause.
Hi, I'm Brian Goddard, I'm a faculty of arts, and I'm doing the Undie Run because it sounds like a lot of fun messing with finals and stuff.
I'm Sharon, I'm a fourth year in LFS. So I heard about the Undie Run first when I saw a video, basically of people running through the library in their underwear, and then I asked someone about it and they said that it was a fundraiser, and thus it went on my bucket list. So this year I decided, yeah, might as well, it's my fourth year, I should do it, so that's why I'm doing it this year.
It's a good way to like let off steam during finals, and running around part naked is always a really good thing.
My name's Elizabeth Barrows, and I am in LFS. I don't know, it's just exciting to be able to go out and do something kind of just college-y. I wasn't too sure about running around mostly naked, just because it's mostly naked, but I mean, how much longer in my life do I get to do these kind of dumb things? So that's the main reason I'm out here, is it's the opportunity, and I might as well do it. I heard about the run through, some of my friends, as well as Facebook, and I had done it the year before, so I knew it was coming up some point. Yeah, it was a lot of fun last year. I was just hoping that the turnout's as good this year because of the rain. Because it's definitely a mob mentality. Once you get, like, start stripping, it's kind of hard to run around naked when you're, you know, just alone in IKB. Sounds a little bit scarier than with, like, 100 other people.
There you have it. Most people heard about it from a friend, saw it on Facebook, thought, heck, why don't I do that? It seems like a good time. And just sort of went for it. You heard a lot of, I might as well do it, from a lot of people. It's a good cause. It's a bunch of half-naked people running around. Why not? So I did have the chance to talk to some people after the run, too, and this is the general response.
It was great! So many hot, naked people!
It was really cold.
It was cold?
Everyone's cold.
And I'm glad that we found a location to swim in, because nice. Outdoor pool's gross.
It was great! Yeah!
So, a lot of people were really excited after the run. Woo! It's great! Yeah! Yeah, so, it sounded like everyone had a great time. It was a little bit cold, but jumping into the wetland kind of made up for it. I suppose. Yeah, that was the fifth annual UBC Undie Run. If this sounded appealing to you, come out next year. The UBC voted it in the top 20 things to do as a UB student, so definitely consider it for the following years to come. Thanks for listening, and have a great fully clothed night.
That was Morme Ziki with a story on the Undie Run.
Her last name is Zanke.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more.
Oh, sorry, we are going to be going straight to the Korean Ferry incident by Christine Kim.
This past Wednesday, a ferry flipped on its side off the southern coast of South Korea near Jindo. And since then, it has been on the hearts and minds of several South Koreans as news continues to grow grimmer day by day. The following is a news clip from April 17th from ABC News. Please take a listen.
And a six-year-old girl is one of the lucky survivors rescued from that sinking ship, but her parents and her brother are still among the missing. This morning, she's in a hospital waiting to hear about the fate of her family. Doctors treating her say she has no external injuries. And some of the grieving families are gathering portside near the scene of the shipwreck, anxiously awaiting good news about their loved ones.
But many are also furious, screaming at officials that they're not doing enough to save their children. ABC's Jui Cho is with them.
On the second day of the ferry accident, rescue efforts are being hampered by poor weather conditions, strong underwater currents, and total lack of organization. Here at the dock of Jindo Island, utter chaos.
They're saying, why aren't you doing anything? Why are you here? What are you doing? You're not doing anything for us.
This morning, we're learning about heartbreaking text messages between students and their family. One 18-year-old woman writing to her father, "Dad, don't worry, I've got a life vest on and we're huddled together." She's still among the missing. Some family members went out to see for themselves this morning the location where students are believed to have been trapped. The only hope is maybe they are inside, saved by an air pocket. This emergency doctor says the emotional stress for these families is causing dehydration and heart problems. From all over the country, volunteers are here, including scuba divers and ex-Marines. This diver says the kids could be anyone's child. He is ready to get down there, but the problem is there are no boats to take them. Juhi Cho at Jindo Island, South Korea.
This incident is one of the worst disasters in recent decades in South Korea. There were reported 475 people on board the ferry, 325 of whom were students, and 15 teachers on a class trip from Danwon High School in Ansan. They were headed to Jeju for a four-day trip. On Tuesday, there was a reported 7 found dead. On Wednesday, 9. And on Thursday, numbers climbed to 28 dead. Yet still, another 450 passengers have yet to be found. Most of the dead bodies were found floating in the ocean, and the rest still, quote-unquote, are missing, and are said to be in a very desperate situation. In combination with being either trapped in the ferry or in the cold seawater, the likelihood of the rest of the 450 missing being found alive are slim. In fact, news reports explain that the water temperature at the time of the tilt was about 12 degrees Celsius, which is a temperature cold enough to cause signs of hypothermia after about an hour and a half of exposure. Nonetheless, divers, helicopters, and boats are continuing their search. However, rescuers are still expressing the slim chance they have in finding survivors. Apparently, more than 600 divers have been thwarted in their attempts to rescue individuals in the boat due to strong current and a bad visibility. Furthermore, Kim Jae-in, a press officer at the Korean Coast Guard in Mokpo, explained that simply pulling the ferry out of the water was extremely dangerous due to the fact that the ferry could easily slip or sink further into the mud. Other attempts by authorities in Korea have been expressed to save the individuals within the boat, but again, the odds are slim. Rescuers attempted to pump air into the ferry in order to increase the odds of survival, and 400 personnel from South Korea's Navy, Air Force, and Army have been sent to aid the area in search and rescue. President Obama has been reported to go visit South Korea in light of this horrific event and has said, quote, "I've directed our military to provide any and all assistance requested by our Korean partners in the days ahead." He said this while also noting that American Navy personnel and U.S. Marines were already on the scene. South Korean President Park Geun-hye said, quote, "I stress again and again that families who are in the most difficult position must be informed of every detail," end quote. And she was speaking about the details of the ferry incident in a meeting with the parents and relatives of the victims. She said, quote, "It's a matter of trust," end quote. News of this capsize has spread globally, and South Korean students here at UBC have expressed their concerns for the families of the students still supposedly missing. Survivors, in fact, of the recent ferry event have recounted their horrific experience and said, quote, "When the ship began tilting, there was a thudding noise, and I thought it was a noise made by students bumping into the wall." Han Hee-min said on Thursday in a hospital in Ansan, which is the city south of Seoul, where the Danwon High School is, said, quote, "I had a life jacket, so I floated. Some friends grabbed my leg. I don't know what happened to them." One South Korean student I spoke to here at UBC expressed her frustration at the reports of the ferry captain's slow actions that have been gaining recently lots of media attention and criticism. Apparently, in light of the ship tipping, the students were ordered to stay put within the ship instead of abandoning it, and as a result, no one was allowed out. The ferry had sent a distress call only 3 hours from its departure, and at that time, a helmsman of the ferry confirmed that the ship was already listing at more than a 5-degree angle, yet an immediate evacuation order was not issued back, as officers in the bridge were reported by a crew member to initially try and stabilize the vessel. Several survivors have confirmed that they were never told to evacuate at any point in the vessel's sinkage, and several social media outlets have shown remarkably live footage of people in life jackets clinging to the sides of the ferry to keep from sliding, while being told to stay within the quarters of the boat. It has also been reported that the ferry's captain was one of the first to flee the boat while the people were instructed over the intercom to stay inside and wait. Kang Hae-sung, the communications officer of the boat, said, quote, "I repeatedly told people to stay calm and stay where they were for an hour," end quote. Furthermore, it was reported by the third mate that once the captain agreed to order an evacuation of the boat, it was by then impossible for crew members to move the passengers from their rooms because the ship was tilted at an incredibly steep angle. The ferry took 2.5 hours to officially capsize and become submerged. Lee Jun-suk, the ship's captain, said, quote, I am really sorry and deeply ashamed. I don't know what to say," end quote. It goes without saying that the 9 crew members and ferry captains that escaped from the wreckage are now under investigation by authorities. The last major ferry incident in South Korea was in 1933, and a reported 292 individuals were killed. For this incident, the death toll is still to be determined.
Thank you, Christine, for that piece. Our next segment is a feature segment by Josh discussing the university's recent announcement of intentions to review its current investments and pursue responsible investment strategies.
Chances are you received a broadcast email from Stephen Toop on Tuesday telling you that the University of British Columbia has taken big steps in promoting, quote, responsible investment practices. The Board of Governors has approved a new endowment responsible investment strategy, which includes a set of criteria for responsible investing and a new advisory committee set up to assess proposals from members of the university and give suggestions on responsible investing. The strategy stopped short of divestment, though, despite the MS referendum question, which saw 77% of the students endorse the removal of endowment investment from fossil fuel holdings. Pascal Spotthelfer is the Vice President of Communications and Community Partnership at UBC. He was reached by phone to talk about the new investment strategy. Can you tell me, or tell the listeners, about how the endowment fund works, first off? What investment makes up the biggest portion of this fund right now?
I can't give insight in what exactly the endowment fund is invested to, given that it's IMANT, the Investment Management Trust of UBC, that manages the money, but they do that by investing into funds. So they do not select the shares they would buy, but they invest the money in funds, and it's fund managers of these funds that then invest the money into specific shares or bonds.
So this is part of why it's been said that it's kind of difficult to directly invest or directly divest from certain funds, that is.
This is correct.
Okay. And what makes this new endowment responsible investment policy different than the last policy that was in place?
We didn't really have a responsible investment policy. So what this policy specifies is number one, that we will use environmental sustainability and governmental principles in our investment decisions. And it also lays out the process on how these ESG principles can be enforced and used. And furthermore, it puts in place a specific board committee that advises the finance committee on matters relating to responsible investing.
And Investment Management Trust Incorporated, that's dealing with the endowment fund, didn't they have a policy for this, for the responsible investing?
They didn't have a policy that went as far as the one that goes now, and there certainly wasn't a process that would allow the stakeholders at the university to participate in this process. And that has been put in place now.
So stakeholders or people that are involved in this process come forward and they submit something to this new advisory committee.
That's correct.
And now, can you tell me a little bit about what's the makeup of this committee? What is their function? How do they work? How do they operate?
The policy specifies the composition of the committee, which consists both of board members and, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't have the policy in front of me, external experts. So it's a mixed committee that assesses the ESG issues and also reports back to the board and to the finance committee on a regular basis.
And when a student or when a group of people with interest come forward to this advisory committee, what would be needed for the committee to take up what they're suggesting?
So there are specific rules with respect to divestment, because divestment is the most severe, the most costly, and also the most complicated action that can be taken under a responsible investment framework. And so there are specific rules with respect to student stakeholders, staff stakeholders, faculty stakeholders, and alumni. So these are the four stakeholder groups who can bring a proposal forward to the task force based on certain quora and voting participation numbers that are specified in the policy.
So we're looking at like 20% quorum or something.
Yes, it's in the case of students, faculty, and staff, it's a 20% participation in the vote with a simple majority. And in the case of the alumni, because it's such a broad and diverse group, it's actually the alumni association board who brings forward a proposal.
Now, I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about, or maybe just ask you, what do you have to say about the symbolic power of divestment?
Well, you know, I can't comment specifically about the divestment as such. I think there is a lot has been written about it, and there's experts who can speak to it. What I know is that the process has been put in place that makes it a possibility, but we should not forget that we have to balance the interests of the university in connection with the endowment fund and the fiduciary duty the university has in realizing the benefits from that endowment fund and the responsible investment principles. And what this policy does, it gives us several measures that can be used, ranging from the selection of the fund managers to direct and collective engagement, and as the most draconian measure, divestment. So I think we can't look at divestment as an in an isolated way.
Thank you very much. Thanks again for talking to me. Have a great day.
Thank you very much, Joshua.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for that, Josh. Now we move to Alasdair Meddling.
Meddling?
Meddling. What's your last name?
Meddling.
Okay,
I'm not meddling with anybody.
I know that.
Anyway,
Meddling with Alasdair Meddling.
What is your piece on, Alasdair?
My piece is on the abortion gap, the genocide awareness group, or an element of them that came on campus two Fridays ago. And basically looking at abortion in general. This is not a particularly, I hope, not particularly controversial piece, and I hope to put forward some of my own solutions for the matter. So, as I said, as many listeners know, 2 weeks ago, we were visited by an element of GAP, the Genocide Awareness Project. The Genocide Awareness Project, and this is taken from their website, is a visual display composed of a 4x8-foot billboards which graphically compare the victims of abortion to victims of other atrocities, such as the Jews in the Holocaust or African Americans during the civil rights struggle in the US. It is typically exhibited at universities or colleges by campus pro-life clubs. Participants engage passers-by in discussion about abortion, as well as hand out pro-life literature. However, this time around, and on Friday, two Fridays ago, they formed a group called Choice Chain, and they chose not to involve the genocide photos, instead showing merely images of aborted fetuses. Earlier this week, I spoke to Zinat Dami, who is the president of the Women's Center here at UBC. She was part of the group that silently protested against the Choice Chain. And you could have seen them standing a short distance away from the Choice Chain protesters, holding signs saying "pro-life is a hate crime" and other such posters. The main reason for this was that the Women's Center felt that it was especially the shaming tactics of Choice Chain, namely a woman holding a sign that read "I regret my abortion," were particularly abhorrent. Now I have very mixed feelings towards the pro-life movement. First of all, as a man, I don't feel particularly able to contemplate, an abortion for myself. I find it very odd that I'm told that I should take a position on what women, whose vaginas I shall never encounter, should do with their wombs. The most disturbing part of this pro-life movement is its aspirations to involve government in limiting abortion terms. A horrible mistake, as the involvement of government regulations often delay the abortions, meaning that the baby is more developed when it's finally terminated. In Canada, around 80% of abortions occur 8 weeks before eight weeks into the pregnancy, and this time could be reduced further if more regulation was scrapped. I also went to GAP's website, and they stated that clandestine abortions would still be able to continue safely under a ban, as abortion technology would ensure this. What a comforting thought. However, on the other hand, there's one merit to their strategy, and that is that it gets people talking about abortion, which is their main goal. Could they have raised this awareness differently for this issue differently? Of course, but I don't think. I don't think it confronting anybody with bloody and exaggerated images is going to get a positive reaction from the majority of the population. But it really made me reconsider my previously vague position on abortion. Before, I would have said that I would have thought it a woman's right to have an abortion, and it's her choice to make, and blah 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 blah, along with all the rest of this passive positivism stance that Western culture has largely adopted over the past 50 to 60 years. But the scenes of abortion really did affect me. So I thought to myself, there must be a better way to reduce the amount of abortions occurring each year, nearly 100,000 in Canada alone. Clearly, abortions can't be a pleasant experience, which is why most women, despite some arguments put forward by parts of the pro-life movement, don't use it as a form of birth control. But what does this mean, 100,000 abortions each year? And what does it say about society that a quarter of all pregnancies are aborted? Well, it means that there's clearly a lot of unwanted pregnancies. But why? And how could we get this number down? Well, this is what I would like to suggest to the pro-life movement. And thank you for those thumbs up. This is what I'd like to suggest forward to the pro-life